Want to support Clock Tower Media and look great while doing it? Check out our official merchandise store, packed with gear inspired by our podcasts and productions. From the Spooky Spectre Sisters apparel to merchandise celebrating your favorite Clock Tower Media shows, we've got something for every fan. Not only will you be showing your support, but every purchase helps us continue creating the content that you love. Visit clocktowermediashop.forthwall.com and grab your favorite merch today.
Welcome to episode 3 of the Sleepy Time Grammar Podcast. So far, you've heard us talk about verbs and nouns. Verb is the action part of the language. It describes things we do and act and be. And nouns, of course, are the words we use to describe people, places, and things. Today, we're going to talk about adjectives. The words that we use to describe nouns. So on this podcast, we always like to start with the definition of the term that we're using. So for today's definition, we're going to turn to the Chicago Guide to Grammar, Usage, and Punctuation. Now, let me tell you, if you ever wanted to learn anything about these topics in as much detail as is humanly possible, this is the book for you. This is published by the Chicago University Press, and the author is Brian A. Garner. He is the author of his own book, well, actually many books, but the one that we refer to often is his Guide to Modern English Usage. He's also the author of the Grammar and Usage chapter in the Chicago Manual of Style. And like I said, he has many other books on language and law, like Legal Writing in Plain English, which was also published by the University of Chicago Press. So let's see what Brian A. Garner in Chicago have to tell us about exactly what these things called adjectives are. Brian says, an adjective is a word modifying a noun or a pronoun. It is often called a describing word. An adjective tells you what sort, how many, how large or small, whom something belongs to, etc. It may modify an understood as well as an expressed noun. For example, he is a good as well as a wise man. An adjective may add a new idea to a noun or a pronoun by describing it more definitely or fully. For example, a red wagon or a human error. Garner notes that adjectives also may be limiting. For example, three pigs. Or this time. So in that case, we're giving a limit to these nouns. We're not talking about all the pigs. We're just talking about these three pigs. Garner notes that most adjectives derive from nouns. For example, plentiful derives from plenty, or stylish derives from style. He notes that some other adjectives derive from verbs, root words, or other adjectives. Now, we have what you could call standalone adjectives, like good or wise or red or blue. Garner notes that we often also use suffixes to create adjectives. He notes that among the suffixes that often distinguish adjectives are able, as in manageable, A-L, as in mystical. A-R-Y, as in elementary. E-D, as in hammered. And in that case, we're not talking about the verb, like he hammered something, but rather, she drank so much whiskey, she was hammered. That's a descriptive adjective. Other suffixes are en, as in wooden, esque, like in statuesque, ful, as in harmful, ible, inaccessible, ic, artistic, ish, foolish, ive, demonstrative, less, helpless, like, childlike, ly, ghostly, ous, perilous, some, lonesome, and just plain old letter Y, as in sunny. But again, he mentions that many adjectives do not have distinctive endings and are recognizable only by their function. Words such as old, tall, or brilliant. Now, I found this paragraph really interesting because I never really thought about how many suffixes we have to create adjectives. And this long list really shows how frequently we use a noun form like would and add a suffix like en to create wooden. Now, Garner gets into a little bit more detail here. And this is a little bit technical, but we'll give it a go. He says, depending on its syntactic position, that means where it is in a sentence, an adjective is either attributive or predicative. An attributive adjective, he says, precedes the noun element, as in good sportsmanship or fine writing. A predicative adjective, also known as a predicate adjective, occurs after a linking verb. And we see that in sentences like the sky is blue, or her hair was golden. A predicate adjective can also come after an object as a compliment. For example, she found him scintillating. Scintillating is describing the guy. Or they considered the problem difficult. And again, even though difficult comes after problem, it's still an adjective describing that word. So now we've had a little bit of a primer on exactly what an adjective is. I want to talk about what you could call two variations on adjectives. And these are comparative and superlative adjectives. Now for this, we're going to look to a really cute little book called Perfect English Grammar. And this is written by Grant Barrett. He's has the national radio show called A Way with Words. He's also an American linguist and a dictionary editor. He writes a lot about slang terms and other new words. And he has also written a different book called The Official Dictionary of Unofficial English. So I think that tells you it's about slang terms. And the Oxford Dictionary of American Political Slang. Oh Lord, I'm not sure I want to get into that topic. But anyway, if the Chicago Guide to Grammar, Usage, and Punctuation is an absolutely exhaustive tome on this topic, Perfect English Grammar is a little paper book that it's a little big to fit in your back pocket, but it's hand size and it tells you the essentials of these topics. So it's a great resource. So let's jump to section 11.2 of this book and see what Barrett has to say about comparative and superlative adjectives. He notes that comparative adjectives are used to compare two nouns, whether they're things, ideas, people, or animals. For example, my bedroom is narrower than her closet. The grass was greener in their yard than it was in ours. My hat is bigger than your hat, but my head is smaller. A naked baby belly is sweeter than a naked adult belly. I'm not really interested in checking out many naked adult bellies, but that's a different topic. So just like we saw in Garner's book, we can see that to create these comparative adjectives, we're using a very specific suffix, er. So we have narrower, greener, bigger, and sweeter. We're going to use a different suffix to create superlative adjectives. And Barrett says that superlative adjectives describe a noun in an extreme way, such as being the most or least, or the best or worst. Generally, superlatives are used to compare an individual item to a group of a similar kind. Some examples here are, our child is clearly the smartest preschooler. Snakes make the best pets. New York City is the largest city in the United States. Now, don't fact check me on that. I'm just reading from this book. So, like we mentioned, to make comparatives, we usually add er to an adjective. To make superlatives, we usually add est. Now, in some cases, the final vowel is changed a little bit or removed to add the suffixes. So let's see some examples. We've got busy, busier, and busiest. So busy ends with a y, but we change it to an I to make busier and busiest. Now, in contrast with the word green, we just add the suffixes, greener and greenest. Now, this is an interesting topic. Some words can't take those suffixes to become comparable or superlative. So we have to add words like more and most. For example, for expensive, we don't say expensiver or expensivest. We have to say more expensive or most expensive. Same thing with fun. We don't say it was funner or the funnest. We tend to say more fun or most fun. Now, this word in particular points to our language and transition, because I have to say, I am starting to see funner or the funnest in modern usage. So we'll keep track of that one, because although that wasn't considered proper in the past, I have a feeling that, let's say in 20 years, those are just going to become standard part of our terminology here in English. Now, I want to turn to something that I think is kind of funny that's related to this, and it's from a book called Words and Rules, The Ingredients of Language. And this is written by the incomparable Steven Pinker, who also wrote The Language Instinct, The Better Angels of Our Nature, and many other topics. He's a professor in psychology at Harvard University and is also a fantastic linguist to boot. So in Words and Rules, he looks at what he calls the mysteries of language. And he does that by looking at something that seems pretty simple, regular and irregular verbs and examining them from every angle: historical, linguistic, mental, human. So I want to look at the section here where he talks about how children, when they're learning language, naturally gravitate toward learning rules and following rules. And they don't always get the weird conventions of our language that we've come to know over time. So let's look at what Pinker has to say, particularly related to this topic of comparative and superlative adjectives. Pinker says, children regularize almost anything they can. They put ED not only on irregular stems, as in braked and eated, and he means verb stems there, but also on irregular past tense forms, as in broked or ated. They put it on their own neologisms, meaning a new word. So, they put ED also on their own words that they've made up, such as punked, lightninged, or spidered. They put it on past tense forms that already have a suffix, as in sweepened, preceded, or my brother got sick and puked. So he notes that past tense is not the only source of irregularity in English, and it's not the only regular pattern that children overgeneralize. Alongside past tense errors, such as braked and putted, we find plural errors, such as man's, foot's, tooth's, and mouse's. He also notes that the suffixes, again, ER and EST, are used to turn many adjectives into comparative or superlative forms. And he notes that it's easy to forget that this rule has exceptions until we hear children adding suffixes to them. They overgeneralize the suffixes to polysyllabic adjectives, as in specialer, or powerfulest, or gooder. He notes that children often generalize from adjectives like fourth, fifth, and sixth, following those rules to create oneth, tooth, and threeth, or sometimes even firsteth, secondeth, and thirdeth. They leap from myself, yourself, and herself to hisself, from ourselves and yourselves to theirselves. Pinker calls children overzealous grammarians, trying to take the rules that their little brains are being taught and applying them uniformly across all similar words in the language. Pretty interesting and pretty cool to listen to little kids doing that. I'm going to jump now to talking about something called unit modifiers, another special type of adjective. Unit modifiers are two words that, when you put them together, they describe a noun, and they're almost always hyphenated. So we could think of a old school record, with old school being hyphenated. Those are two nouns put together to create one adjective, what we call a unit modifier. For a little bit more elaboration on this, we're going to take a peek at a different style guide. This is the ACS style guide, published by the American Chemical Society. So they note that most unit modifiers consist of a noun and an adjective, like a time-dependent reaction or a radiation-sensitive compound. They can include an adjective and a noun, like a high-frequency transition or a first-order reaction. They can also include an adjective and a participle, a slow-growing tree, or a far-reaching influence. They can include a noun and a participle, a time-consuming project, or silver-coated electrode. They can include an adverb and an adjective, like above-average results, or a still unproven technique. And, like we talked about first, it can simply be two nouns put together, as in an iron exchange resin, a liquid crystal polymer, or gas phase hydrolysis. Now, believe it or not, following this pretty straightforward description, in the ACS style guide, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 full pages of clarification on when you hyphenate certain unit modifiers and when you don't. And if you happen to be a copy editor yourself, you are probably aware that when to hyphenate compound modifiers, when to keep them open, and when to close them up to create one single word is a constant source of confusion. These are constantly things that we're looking up in dictionaries, in style guides, or in house guides for a certain company or organization that we might work for. So ACS gives some guidance on this, on terms that are peculiar to the world of chemistry. So for example, they tell us to hyphenate combinations of color terms that are used as unit modifiers, as in a blue-green solution or a red-black precipitate. Now, the next rule is one that doesn't just apply to chemistry. This applies across the board. You don't hyphenate unit modifiers if the first word is an adverb ending in ly. For example, accurately measured values or a recently developed procedure. Now, in those instances, there is no hyphen between accurately and measured. No hyphen between recently and developed. Jumping back to things we do hyphenate. You hyphenate unit modifiers with the adverbs like well, ever, or little. For example, a well-known scientist or an ill-fitting stopper. Hold your horses, because there's another clarification. You don't hyphenate unit modifiers when they contain these adverbs if they are modified by another adverb. For example, you might have the most ill-advised investment or a very high-density lipoprotein. So all of a sudden, the hyphen that would normally come between high and density, if you just said high-density lipoprotein, is voided if we add the very. So very high-density lipoprotein gets no hyphens. You can start to see why this is a subject that copy editors are constantly having to look up. Now, this is another interesting variation on the on this theme. We note that when two or more unit modifiers with the same ending base modify one noun, we use a hyphen after each element, but we do not repeat the ending base. So for example, if we have the sentence first and second order reactions, there's a hyphen after the word first, but it doesn't connect anything. It's just kind of dangling there. And then there's a hyphen between second and order. So that kind of dangling hyphen there indicates to us that first is still connected to that ending base, the word order. In other words, it's cluing us in that this phrase actually is referring to first order and second order reactions. But we don't have to repeat that word twice in the sentence. Another area where you don't hyphenate a unit modifier is if one of the words is a proper name. For example, they cite terms like the Lewis acid catalysis. This is another word I don't know how to pronounce. Catalysis? That sounds better. So we've got a Lewis acid catalysis or a Schiff base measurement. Now, when I was a little kid, my mom always told me that not knowing how to pronounce certain words is actually a good thing because it means you're well-read and you've read many more words than you've ever heard spoken or spoken yourself. So I'm gonna try to give myself a pat on the back for this rather than feeling kind of silly because I don't know how to pronounce all these words. This section goes on and on and on, but there's one other point I do want to share because this comes up often for copy editors. So the question is this: when a unit modifier comes after a noun, in other words, when it's used as a predicate adjective, do we hyphenate it or not? So different style guides give us different guidance on this point. But according to the ACS style guide, again, that's published by the American Chemical Society, they say that you should. So in a sentence like, the antibody is species specific is hyphenated. The reaction is first order is hyphenated. So again, this is an almost endless topic. What unit modifiers do you hyphenate? What do you not? You can turn to your dictionary for guidance on this. You can turn to whatever style guide is used mainly in your industry, whether it's the ACS style guide, APA, the Associated Press style book, AMA, which is published by the American Medical Association. Believe it or not, all of these guides might have slightly different guidance on when you hyphenate these terms and when you don't. It's a little bit mind-boggling, but this is the job we signed up for when we became copy editors. Next, we're going to dive into the topic of the order of adjectives. And this addresses a question. When more than one adjective comes before a noun, what order should they go in? Well, this is pretty fascinating because guess what? There is a standard order for adjectives, but it's not something we were ever taught in school. It's something that is almost inherently understood and passed along from parents and caregivers to children as they hear us speak, and they adopt this almost natural order of adjectives. Because there is an order of adjectives that's very standard in our language that we use almost automatically when we describe something. So the order of adjectives is this. Number one, opinion. Two, size. Three, physical quality. Four, shape. Five, age. Six, color. Seven, origin. Eight, material. Nine, type. And 10 is purpose. I bet you never even thought there could be so many different types of adjectives. that would come before a noun. But if we do put these together, we start to see that, gosh darn it, there is a standard pattern to how we use adjectives. So let's look at a few different sentences, and these are examples given by the Cambridge Dictionary online. So they cite some sentences like, the object was made of a strange green metallic material. Strange, falling into the category of opinion, is number one on our list in the order of adjectives. Green is number six, color. Number eight is metallic material. So we don't think a lot about this. It sounds normal to say it was made of strange green metallic material. But think how weird it would sound and disorienting to the ear if we reversed those. Would we ever say something that was made out of metallic, strange green material? Here's another example from them. Panettone is round, Italian, bread-like Christmas cake. Round is number four in our order of adjectives, denoting shape. Number seven, Italian, denotes origin. And number nine denotes type. It's a bread-like Christmas cake. Now, here are some examples where we would really not string this many adjectives one after another in a sentence. But again, it shows us the pattern, the almost never-changing pattern of adjectives, order of adjectives that we use. So let's look at this pretend sentence. She was a beautiful, tall, thin, young, black-haired Scottish woman. So again, we see this almost unchanging order of adjectives. First, number one is opinion. She's beautiful. Number two, we see size. She was tall. Number three, we see physical quality. She was thin. Number five, we see age. She was young. Six, color, black-haired. Seven, Scottish, that denotes origin. So very interesting that we have this almost unchanging order of adjectives, and we just use it naturally when we're describing something. So next time you're describing a noun with more than one adjective, or if you're writing a sentence, pay attention to the order of adjectives that you use and see if it happens to line up with what we've just talked about. So far, we've been talking about what adjectives are and some of the different types of adjectives and how we use them correctly in sentences. Now, it's important to add to this topic that lots of people don't like adjectives. That may be a bit of an exaggeration, but lots of our most well-reputed authors and well-respected writing teachers encourage us to go slow and cautiously with adjectives, rather than simply pouring them into our writing without a lot of thought. Here are a couple quotes from some different authors. Henry James said that if the noun is good and the verb is strong, you almost never need an adjective. Ann Carson says that the adjective is the banana peel of the parts of speech. Now, C.S. Lewis doesn't say we shouldn't use adjectives, but he encourages us to use them cautiously. He says that in your writing, don't use adjectives which merely tell us how you want us to feel about the thing you're describing. Instead of telling us a thing was terrible, describe it so that we'll be terrified. Don't say it was, quote, delightful. Make us say delightful after we've read the description. Ben Yagoda has a similar quote. He says, regarding adjectives, I would say, number one, be sparing. The analogy, I would say, is with cooking and spices. You could say that the nouns and the verbs are the meat or the stew, and the adjectives and adverbs are the seasoning. If you use too many spices or too much spice, they drown each other out. So, all of these perspectives underline the idea that strong nouns and verbs lead to powerful writing. And while adjectives can add some flair, they want to be chosen with the utmost care and used when they're helping us to paint a picture of a specific scene or a specific feeling. With that in mind, I'm going to read to you from one of my favorite books. It's called The Man in the Queue, written by Josephine Tay. And I think this passage and the other ones I'm going to share show how adjectives can be used really successfully to paint a scene in an evocative way and absolutely draw you into a scenario so you can almost see it in front of you and feel the air on your skin or taste the way that that air feels. So again, this quote is from, like I said, Josephine Tay. She is a Scottish author who wrote during the golden age of British crime. Her novel called The Daughter of Time is considered one of the greatest crime novels of all time. Unfortunately, she only wrote 8 novels in her life. I could read an endless number of novels by Josephine Tay, probably because mysteries are about my favorite genre next to science fiction. So let's look at a couple excerpts from The Man in the Queue and see how Josephine Tay is using adjectives. Now, to set the stage, this scene describes her detective, Inspector Grant, traveling into Scotland for one of the first times. Several miles before Garney, Grant smelt the sea, that seaweedy smell of the sea on an indented coast. It was strange to smell it so unpreparedly in such unsea-like surroundings. It was still more strange to come on it suddenly as a small green pool among the hills. Only the brown surge of the weed along the rocks proclaimed the fact that it was ocean and not more luck. The long line of Garney sands lay bare in the evening light, a violet sea creaming gently on their silver placidity. The car decanted him at the flagged doorway of his hostelry, but hungry as he was, he lingered in the door to watch the light die beyond the flat purple outline of the islands to the west. The stillness was full of the clear, faraway sounds of evening. The air smelt of peat smoke in the sea. The first lights of the village shone daffodil clear here and there. The sea grew lavender, and the sands became a pale shimmer in the dusk. So, in this passage, I feel like we see adjectives used in with all the force that they can bring to color our writing and to make it stand out as distinct. I love her use of the seaweedy smell of the sea I like when she talks about it being in such un-sea-like surroundings. That's also a neologism, a new term, you could say. Have you ever heard anything described as un-sea-like before? I like the simplicity of some of her adjectives, talking about the small green pool among the hills, or the brown surge of weed. So next time you're reading, lean in to the adjectives. See what treats your author has for you in store. Maybe it'll be a violet sea, or clear, faraway sounds of evening, or air that smelt of peat smoke, a lavender sea, or pale, shimmering sands. Thanks for listening to our episode on adjectives. So that's the end of today's Sleepy Time Grammar podcast. Our podcast is presented by Dragonfly Editorial, and our producer is Clock Tower Media out of Tip City, Ohio. I'm Samantha Enslin with Dragonfly Editorial. And thanks for joining us today. Read, relax, let your cares drift away into that wonderful world of words. See you next time.
Looking for a professional team to bring your podcast or video production to life? At Clock Tower Media, we proudly edit and produce a growing lineup of shows, including The Downtown Lowdown, Newsmakers, Spectre Sisters, Cocktails and Carry-Ons, Dreams of Future Past, Talk Proper, Sleepy Grammar, and many more. Whether you're an experienced creator or just getting started, our team can help with audio editing, video production, graphics, publishing, and everything in between. We believe every great story deserves great production. Have an idea for a podcast or show? We're always looking for new productions to join the Clock Tower Media family. Visit clocktowermedia.com today and let's create something amazing together.